You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight includes claims of sovereignty. That is, your laws don't apply to me. Our guests tonight are unusual in the sense that each is an attorney who brings a tremendous amount of experience with this topic before going to law school and practicing law. In the studio with me tonight is David Nazaro, an attorney in San Mateo, California. David, before attending law school, attained his master's in national security studies as well as strategic intelligence. And it was a career change that brought him to law. Also with me tonight is over the telephone, Kathleen Sherman. Kathleen is an attorney in San Jose, author of the book, A Housekeeper is Cheaper Than a Divorce, Why You Can Afford to Hire Help and How to Get It, which is available free for download on her website at www.kathleensherman.law. Before beginning her practice, in which Kathleen is becoming a go-to star in the field of white-collar criminal defense and business litigation, Kathleen was the criminal research attorney for the San Mateo County Superior Court, and again, brings a wealth of knowledge as it relates to claims of sovereignty, people that claim to be sovereign citizens, and therefore the courts can't reach them. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, we do have a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Now, I want to start by inviting anybody out there who is personally familiar with claims of sovereignty to call in. We'll respect your privacy, but we'd really like to hear from you. And again, our phone number to hear right here in the studio is 866-798-8255. And with that, I'd like to welcome both of my guests, David, Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
One of the things that I discovered in trying to put this show together, I was looking for leadership. I was looking for somebody in the sovereign movement that I could contact to invite on the show, someone that we could bring forward to bring in another perspective. And what I found is that seems that this is a movement devoid of leadership. Would either of you care to comment on that?
Well, that's exactly right, Jeff. There is no clear definitive leader to this movement. There also are no clear seminal texts either. The sovereign citizen movement is difficult to pin down for a number of reasons. It's influenced by a number of different sources, including some that are very old. And this results in a confusing worldview and often an incoherent narrative of American history. Also, the movement is constantly mutating as sovereign ideas extend online into other fringe and extremist circles. And it can often be difficult to distinguish between someone who's a sovereign citizen and someone who's not.
And again, you mentioned about extremists and circles that this travels in, but not everybody espousing these views are extremists, correct?
That's right. In fact, I think most of them here in San Mateo County are not. I think almost all of them are not extremists. Most of them are people who probably are economically or socially marginalized in some way, and they go online and they get introduced to some of these radical ideas, and they bring them into the courts. And where I see this myself is either in traffic court or in child support contempt court.
Kathy, let me start with you. What was it that brought this whole movement to your attention?
Well, I was, as you mentioned, Jeff, used to be a criminal research attorney for San Mateo County Superior Court. And one correction to what you said, that was right after I got out of law school. It wasn't before I went to law school. It was before I became a litigator, so kind of in between law school and my litigation career. And as research attorneys for the court, our job was to review the briefs that anybody had filed with the court in any felony case. And that included petitions for writ of habeas corpus that were sent into the court by people in state prison who had been convicted of felonies in San Mateo County Superior Court and then sentenced to state prison. Now, a habeas petition, as you know, is or a writ of habeas petition. Let me try that one more time. A writ of habeas corpus, which literally means free the body, is a legal brief that says to the court, I am being illegally imprisoned and therefore free my body. We would get writs of habeas corpus from state prisoners, the vast majority of which were actually based on cogent legal argument, relied on constitutional principles, statutory principles, case law. But a very small percentage were from people who considered themselves sovereign. And these petitions would be extremely voluminous, and they would be completely incoherent. And as research attorneys, our job was to summarize the briefs that we had received, write a bench memo to give to the judge, and make a recommendation for what the judge should do with them. The petitions that came from sovereigns were really confounding, because we would, of course, always try to give everybody a fair hearing, due process, to, you know, seriously consider what they had to say. But it was very challenging for us to do this for these sovereign citizen habeas petitions. And over time, we began to recognize a pattern of the kinds of things that they would say. And now, 13 years later, I have come to learn that this is actually a movement that's been around for decades, if not longer than that, and is becoming more predominant.
David, given your background in national security, what brought your attention to the sovereign citizens?
Well, I got introduced to this when I was on the child support contempt calendar in San Jose a few years ago. And I was walking through the halls of the old Notre Dame courthouse when a muscular, angry young man stopped me in the halls and asked if he could ask me a question.
And before you go on, when you say the old Notre Dame courthouse, to those that aren't familiar, that was one of the courthouses in Santa Clara County?
That's correct. That was the Notre Dame Avenue courthouse that used to do mostly child support and child support-related motions and hearings.
And how does all this relate to child support?
It relates to child support because many sovereign citizens use sovereign citizen ideology and pseudo-linguistic language that they espouse to try to avoid paying child support. Usually what they do is they try to make an argument that the court doesn't have jurisdiction, and therefore they can't be forced to pay child support.
Does that extend outside of child support? Are there other arenas where they take this position?
There's quite a few other places where this happens. It happens a lot in traffic court. There are many sovereign citizens who drive without a license. Some of them do it intentionally. Here in San Mateo County, I don't think they do it intentionally very often. Or here in the Bay Area, I don't think they do it very often. But in other places of the country, they will do it intentionally, hoping that the police will pull them over because they want to make a statement. Also, you see this in not just throughout family court in general. You'll see it in custody cases sometimes when it relates to the gentleman wants to avoid his children being vaccinated. They will use sovereign citizen ideology. And it can happen really throughout the criminal courts almost anywhere.
And do you find this in the civil courts as well?
Well, I'm not in the civil courts, so I can't say. But yes, I know that the sovereign citizens do file a lot of liens, and they'd like to file liens against law enforcement officials, government officials, judges, prosecutors, attorneys. And sometimes they can file so many of these, they can file a ridiculous number of liens into the billions of dollars to try to harass. Some have called this a form of paper terrorism.
So I would ask both of you, Are these people getting anywhere in claiming the government doesn't have authority over them, they can't be pulled over, they can't get a ticket, they don't have to pay their child support, they're really beyond the reach of our laws? Are they getting anywhere with this?
Well, I can tell you that they certainly never got anywhere when I was a research attorney in San Mateo County Superior Court. I've done, just out of curiosity, I did some poking around on the internet to see what I could find. And universally, these defenses fail. Courts sometimes try to understand the arguments, again, out of a commitment to due process, are left scratching their heads, and universally have denied these defenses.
And David, what do you find? Do you find that these folks are getting anywhere?
I have never seen sovereign citizen ideology ever lead to anything constructive for the person that espouses it. Also online, if you poke around online and go onto YouTube, there's a whole series of videos called Sovereign Citizens Fails, Sovereign Citizens Get Tased that are actually very popular. And they range from humorous to downright frightening what some of these individuals are doing, both in the courts and when they get pulled over by law enforcement officials. I've never seen it ever actually work out for their benefit.
And you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden. My guests tonight are Kathleen Sherman, white-collar criminal defense, as well as business litigation, and David Nazaro, who is from San Mateo, California. And our number here in the studio is 841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. And again, I want to invite anybody who is personally familiar with the claim of sovereignty, someone who may have used it themselves, whether it's for a traffic ticket, whether it's to fight a criminal case or not, or not be subject to the courts for whatever reason that they feel is legitimate, I would very much like to hear from you. And again, please feel free to call us right here in the studio at 415-841-4134. We will preserve your identity. We will keep it confidential. But I would very much like to hear from people out there who may have a different take on this, who may have a different viewpoint. And I guess one of the things we could do is really start from the beginning. How did all this get started? Does any of you have a take on that?
So the sovereign citizen movement started generally as an anti-government movement in the 1960s. It can be traced back to several forerunners, one being Posse Comitatus. I don't know how to pronounce that. That was organized here in California and also in Oregon. It was a movement of tax protesters, and it attracted a lot of white supremacists and anti-Semites. And their chief belief was that the county is the highest government authority. Since then, there's been a real evolution, or some might even say de-evolution of this movement. The sovereign citizen movement really expanded in the 1990s with the rise of a lot of other right-wing movements. And it was fueled by the same things. They have the same complaints, the same grievances. Ruby Ridge in 1992, Waco, Texas in 1993. And now with the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, it's really appealed to people who are economically marginalized. And it comes at a time when social media has really taken over. So the internet and Facebook and YouTube allow for the dissemination of a lot of different points of view. And you would think that the marketplace of ideas would allow these views to either die out or be competed with, but it appears that that's not actually happening. Instead, they seem to be spreading, despite the fact that there's quite a bit of criticism of this online. But the people who want to see this point of view espoused don't seem to go to the critical sites. They only go to the sites that seem to espouse it.
One of the things that I've thought about in reading these arguments of sovereign citizens is the logical inconsistency. So, for example, one of the things that they claim is that the United States government and the governments of the states are illegitimate governments. And therefore, because they're illegitimate governments, they have no jurisdiction over these individuals. And so therefore, when they're prosecuted, when they're issued traffic tickets, whatever the case may be, those are illegitimate because the government is illegitimate. But those are, in my mind, illogical arguments for a couple reasons. One is, and one of the things they say is they haven't consented to jurisdiction. But suppose that you're traveling in a foreign country and you commit a crime under the laws of that country. You can be arrested and prosecuted in that country, and it's no defense to say, well, I didn't consent to your jurisdiction, because you have availed yourself of that jurisdiction by being there. And I think in the same way, these so-called sovereign citizens have availed themselves of the jurisdictions of wherever they live in the United States by living here, driving on the roads, sending their kids to schools, using public utilities such as water and garbage. So they avail themselves of things they like, and then they reject things they don't like. So that's a logical inconsistency that I haven't seen answered by any of these sovereign citizens.
Now, you've spoken about some pretty extreme views, but I imagine there are gradations in how far people go. What does this really mean to the rest of us? Not everybody is wanting to cordon themselves off and declare their homes a sovereign nation. But are there lesser involvements or lesser uses of these claims that might be something we would see more from day to day?
Well, there's degrees of extremism here. But I think it's important to go back to talk about what the belief system is in a nutshell, if I could, just for a minute, Jeff. So the Anti-Defamation League put it this way. In a nutshell, sovereign citizen ideology claims that some time ago, a conspiracy began to infiltrate and subvert the original legitimate de jure government, slowly replacing it with an illegitimate, tyrannical, de facto government. And the people who discover this truth can take steps to divorce themselves from the illegitimate government, becoming sovereign citizens. And once they've done so, they're essentially immune to the laws, rules, regulations, taxes, in the courts of the illegitimate government, which has no jurisdiction over them. So what we see is a range of that, which ranges from something as simple as someone who gets a speeding ticket or a fix-it ticket and doesn't believe the traffic court can enforce any kind of criminal penalty on them, to someone who goes to the other extreme and acts violently against a judge, a police officer, or a government official.
Now, locally, we haven't heard a lot of violence against police officers or judges from people that espouse those views, but have we seen these types of views locally with regards to whether it's traffic tickets or child support or things of that nature?
Well, just on Monday in Santa Clara, I saw a sovereign citizen within the traffic court who was being more of a nuisance than anything else. And I think that's really where it manifests itself here on the peninsula. It's more of a nuisance that clogs up the courts. It takes up a lot of time. It makes it difficult for the courts to properly function, for the judges to do their jobs, for the attorneys to do their jobs, for the citizens who also have cases in the court to have their case heard and be given proper time.
Is this a cohesive movement? Are there people that are somehow connected or share views, have a common ideology?
It's largely not cohesive, but it shares a basic belief that the government is illegitimate. That's the starting point. And from that point, it then overlaps and merges and morphs into other groups. And it isn't just right wing either. It started mostly with from the hard political right, but now you also see it on the hard left. There is an expert, J.M. Berger of George Washington University, who describes the sovereign citizen movement as actually being more consistent with left-wing anarchist ideology than with the ideology of the hard right now.
We've seen, as attorneys around the courthouse, we've tended to see views, people that espouse things such as the Uniform Commercial Code doesn't apply. I'm not in contract with you as a judge, so you can't tell me what to do. And that makes that begs the question, do they have attorneys guiding them? Are there attorneys for this movement? Kathy, do you have any views on that?
Well, none of the sovereign citizens had ever submitted any habeas petitions to the court when I was a research attorney had attorneys. And I began to ask myself that question, why are they not represented by counsel? And when I was looking around online for cases in which the sovereign citizen defense was presented, in no example could I find were the usually criminal defendants ever represented by counsel who was putting forth that argument. And I asked myself why that is, and I concluded that it's because it would be unethical for an attorney to do so. Here in California, we as attorneys are bound by rules of ethics that are codified in two places. One is in the California Business and Professions Code, Section 6068, and the other is in the California State Bar Rules of Professional Conduct. And so in California Business Code, Section 6068, the very first item that's listed under duties of attorney is the duty to support the Constitution and the laws of the United States and of this state, i.e. of California. The whole premise of the sovereign citizen movement is that the Constitution is invalid and the laws of the United States are invalid because the United States government is illegitimate, and the same for the laws of the state of California. Well, how could an attorney ethically support the Constitution, the laws of the United States, and the laws of the state of California on behalf of a client who they are going to argue there is no law? I don't think it could be done. Under the California State Bar Rules of Professional Conduct, specifically Rule 3-200, that rule says, a member, i.e. a member of the state bar, shall not seek, accept, or continue employment if the member knows or should know that the objective of such employment is to present a claim or defense in litigation that is not warranted under existing law unless it can be supported by a good faith argument for an extension, modification, or reversal of such existing law. So clearly, we want lawyers to be free to make good faith arguments that new law should be made, or, for example, a certain interpretation of the Constitution is wrong and should be overruled by an appellate court. But that is very different from an argument that there is no law. And I think for that reason, representing a sovereign citizen and putting forth those arguments would be prohibited under State Bar Rule 3-200, and an attorney would be risking their license if they represented such a person.
And again, just to clarify what you're saying, there's no reason to stop any attorney from representing these folks. The question is whether, as attorneys, we can espouse those views and actually proceed with this legal theory, basically claiming that the entirety of the government is unlawful.
Well, I can tell you how I would react if somebody contacted me and said, I'm a sovereign citizen and I want you to put forth, you know, these arguments in court. I would say, no, thank you. It's not worth risking my license over this, because my reading of my ethical obligations is that I can't make those arguments in court. I'm ethically prohibited from making those arguments in court.
And for those of you listening that are listening live and not watching the Warrior game, our number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden, and in the studio with me tonight is David Nazaro, an attorney in San Mateo, California. And on the telephone with us tonight is Kathleen Sherman, an attorney in San Jose, and author of the book, A Housekeeper is Cheaper Than a Divorce, Why You Can Afford to Hire Help and How to Get It. And a free download is available at her website, Kathleen Sherman Law.
Yeah.
I knew I would get that right if I repeated it. And again, we're talking about claims of sovereignty, that is, those that say that your laws, your government, don't apply to me. I want to encourage anybody listening who feels that the government doesn't have jurisdiction over them, that they are sovereigns, I would encourage you to call in. We would all very much welcome hearing what you have to say. We don't want to minimize it. We would like to hear from you. We will protect your identity. We just want to hear from you. David, did you have something you were looking to add?
I wanted to add something to our conversation earlier about why there aren't attorneys who are representing sovereign citizens. And one of the beliefs that some sovereign citizens have is that the original purpose of the 13th Amendment was to bar attorneys from the practice of law. And so one of the things that you see are sovereign citizens who claim to be attorneys. They'll call themselves names like Private Attorney General John Doe, for example. There was one in Hawaii who was very disruptive over there. They also will claim to be judges, and sometimes in the most extreme cases will claim to have their own courts and will issue bench warrants for judges, for prosecutors, and for other attorneys. Sovereign citizens in general don't trust attorneys and don't trust members of the bar and prefer to represent themselves pro se because they believe that they are espousing the truth and members of the bar are not.
Once again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 here in San Francisco. And we will return right after this.
This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
We've been speaking about a broad movement which is has some frightening undertones to it, some broad-reaching rejection of what we would consider the government, what we consider the protector of our freedoms, and the builder of the infrastructure around us. But I'd like to take a smaller look, a more localized look, in what we see from day to day. What does that mean, believing in sovereignty, or maybe just asserting a claim of sovereignty, to somebody, for example, fighting a traffic ticket?
Well, it means that to someone fighting a traffic ticket, to someone who has, let's say, just a simple speeding ticket, it often means that they'll come into court and they'll challenge the jurisdiction of the court. They'll be very disruptive from the start. And one of the things that they'll do is they won't want to come up front. They'll stay out in the back benches. They'll say things like, I don't consent into entering into a contract with you or entering into a contract with this court. They'll say that this court has no jurisdiction because it uses admiralty law. They may demand that the American flag be removed because they believe it's an admiralty flag and that only the President of the United States can have it in the White House and things like this. So mostly they're a real nuisance to the courts. They're a real nuisance to the people in the courts, and they make the everyday functioning of the courts more difficult for everyone.
And where else do we see this today? You mentioned child support. What would happen in that arena?
Essentially, it's an offshoot of the same thing. So they will challenge the jurisdiction of the court. They will say that the court cannot compel them to pay child support. They will cite Supreme Court cases that don't exist, saying that the Supreme Court has found that child support is unconstitutional. And they'll generally make it very, very difficult for the court to enforce child support orders or for mothers to receive the support that they've been ordered.
And do they interfere with these courts functioning, whether it's child support or traffic, for example?
Yes, they're very disruptive to the courts and can make it very difficult just to function on a very basic level, to get through the calendar even.
I think in order to understand that, it might be helpful to paint a picture of what traffic court looks like, particularly after the budget cuts.
And with that in mind, Kathy, you've served as a judge pro tem in traffic court, so you know the look of that court pretty well.
Yeah, so for a couple years, I volunteered as a judge in traffic court in San Mateo County, and that was right around the time that we were seeing the budget cuts following the downturn in 2008. And the calendars went from about 100 line numbers a morning to about 200 on an arraignment calendar in traffic court. And so for the layperson to understand what that means, you get a traffic citation, you're given a date to appear in court, you show up with 100 other people, and at the arraignment, all you do is plead guilty or not guilty. If you plead not guilty, you get a trial date. If you plead guilty, the judge gives you a fine. And the reason people show up for these arraignment hearings is because they want to ask the court to give them a lower fine. When I was when I was volunteering as a traffic court judge, people would often want to say, I want to plead guilty with an explanation. And all they wanted was 3 minutes to tell me their story. And, you know, it's very, very important that the public in general has a positive impression of our court system and perceives that the court system treats people fairly. And for the vast majority of people, the only interaction they're ever going to have with the court system is traffic court. So I felt that when I was serving as a judge, it was really important that I be able to give people those 3 minutes to just listen to their story. And to be perfectly honest, I probably would have agreed to reduce their fine no matter what, because, you know, really, in reality, that's what judges do. When people take the time to show up, they essentially get a discount for showing up. They get a reduced fine. But for someone to feel like a judge has listened to them is really important. So when the calendars went from 100 line numbers a morning to 200 line numbers a morning, it became more and more difficult to give each defendant the time that they wanted to speak to the court. And when somebody would be on the calendar with an unusual and time-consuming defense, it would have the effect of not only throwing off the whole morning schedule with the potential of not getting through everybody, it would take up time that other citizens really were entitled to get their 3 minutes to tell their story. And keep in mind, when you're sitting in a courtroom with 100 or 200 other people and you've taken off, say, a half day at work just to come and try and get a reduction of fine in your traffic ticket, it's very, very disheartening to not get a chance to do what you came to do.
Now, so far we've spoken about traffic tickets, child support courts, and these are admittedly pretty easy cases. I guess where the rubber meets the road is, what about serious crimes? What about felonies, assault, murder? Does being a sovereign citizen, Would they argue that this entitles them to commit any crimes they want, or just that the government can't deal with it and it's up to their neighbors to deal with them? What's really their beliefs on this?
Well, there have been a number of highly publicized crimes committed by sovereign citizens. Just in April of this year, there was the Waffle House mass shooting by Joseph Paffin, who allegedly is a sovereign citizen. And there's been a number of other shootings like this in Tennessee in May of 2010. Jerry and Joseph Kane, a father and son, shot and killed two Tennessee police officers in a traffic shot, in a traffic stop. And in Nevada in 2013, two sovereigns were arrested for planning to kidnap and kill a Los Angeles police officer. So they're on the extreme side of this. This is very frightening, some of the things that they believe. They can terrorize judges not just with acts of violence but through paper terrorism. There's a judge in New York who had, I think, millions of dollars of liens filed against him by sovereign citizens, and he said he was so terrified of this sovereign citizen who appeared in his traffic court that he began sleeping with a gun under his pillow.
And that's in response to violence or paper or a little of both?
That was in response originally just to all the paper that was being filed against him, all these frivolous liens. But as this case moved on, he realized that there were cases throughout the country where sovereign citizens were targeting judges with violence and also targeting police officers. The FBI calls sovereign citizens domestic terrorists. And I think it's important to recognize that law enforcement agencies are afraid of sovereign citizens because of how difficult they can be when they get pulled over at a traffic stop. In 2014, there was a survey conducted on what U.S. police officers considered to be their greatest threat, and they named sovereign citizens to be the greatest threat to law enforcement. Islamic terrorism came second.
So as someone who sits occasionally in traffic court, should Kathy Rye worry that the people that get in front of us and say, you have no jurisdiction over me, you can't enforce that ticket, might be connected to something larger and more sinister?
I am unaware of any plot like that taking place in this particular part of the country. However, I do think it's important that those who sit on the courts, both in traffic and in child support and elsewhere, become more aware of this. I think it's important that law enforcement become more aware of what it is that they're dealing with, because this is a subculture that's growing. And at its extreme, it is violent. It does espouse violence against people who sit on the courts, who are law enforcement officers and who are attorneys as well. So I think an awareness of this is something that needs to be highlighted in trainings through the Bar Association and in other places.
One of the things I'm having a little trouble with, and I would ask each of you to consider whether you can help connect the dots for me. We hear about pretty horrific acts by people done in the name of their sovereign citizen rights that take place mostly in other places. But here locally, we see people that have claimed to be sovereign, claimed that there's no jurisdiction over them in much smaller ways, or by filing petitions for unrelated acts that they may have been convicted of or in earlier dates. How is that information getting disseminated? How are these people getting so educated or miseducated to where they're adopting views espoused by much more frightening people?
Oh, Jeff, I wanted to tell you about this thing you might not have heard of yet. It's called the internet.
What's that?
I mean, really, how do any of these crazy theories spread? And particularly now with, you know, the ability to post videos on YouTube. I mean, isn't that one way that the that this movement is escalating since the early 2000s?
They are on YouTube. They are on Facebook. And there are self-proclaimed sovereign citizen gurus who will hold seminars where they will teach people or give them advice on how to beat a traffic ticket or how to avoid paying child support or how to drive without a license. And so it's being disseminated online. It's also being disseminated throughout the prisons. So people who are in prison will get sovereign citizen literature or copies of petitions, and they will copy and paste these things and get introduced to sovereign citizen ideology that way. I think that most of the people that we see in the local courts who espouse sovereign citizen ideology are not hardcore sovereign citizens. I think they're people who've been introduced to this ideology within a very short period of time of when they first appear in the courts. And really what they're looking for is some way out. They go online, they have a problem. The problem is that they're being charged with driving on a suspended license or being driving without a license at all. And they want to find some way, somehow, to avoid punishment. And they go online, they go to YouTube, and they see a video that leads them to some self-proclaimed guru who can give them the answer. And they go to this site, and they sometimes they pay money for it, sometimes they get it for free. And they then believe that this is the truth, and they show up a short time later in court mimicking what it is that they've heard online, mimicking what it is that they've read, and try to use that ideology in court. But one of the things that I find particularly interesting about this particular movement is that the people that I've seen appear to be sincere in their beliefs. They appear to sincerely believe that this is the truth, that they have found some hidden truth that most people don't know of, and they're utterly convinced that this is going to work and are surprised when it doesn't.
I guess when you bring up the internet and the view of a conspiracy that we all participate in as lawyers, it would look very much the same from the other side looking at us. Here we are on the internet. I imagine many of our listeners are going to be listening after the Warrior game is over rather than live. So they're listening to us on www.kalw.org, espousing views that maybe are quite different than theirs. For those that are listening tonight live, I would encourage you to call in if you do have some experience with claims of being a sovereign citizen, whether your own experiences, whether it's an ill-fated attempt at a defense, or maybe a truly heartfelt belief that our government's illegitimate and we need to start taking action. We would very much like to hear from you. You are welcome to call with your name. You're welcome to call anonymously, but we would like to hear what you have to tell us. Our number here is 866-798-8255. And again, that number, toll-free, 866-798-8255. And I guess I would ask each of you, where is this all going? Is there some way to reconcile what we think of as a legitimate government, what we think of as the people that are out there building our roads that sovereigns and the rest of us alike drive, or that steer the economy that helps to feed all of us, and those that believe these are not viable institutions built by our creators? How do we bring people together? What's our next move?
Well, that's a tough question. That is like the question of how do you get Trump supporters and never Trumpers to find common ground.
And actually, we're going to be taking up Trump next week. Next week on Your Legal Rights, our topic is going to be not necessarily our current president, but the president in general, the inherent powers of the president. My guest will be discussing whether the president can be subpoenaed or compelled to answer questions, can simply shut down the Russia investigation, or maybe just pardon himself. That's next week's show. We're not really intending to go there, but one of the things that struck me when we were talking earlier, when you brought up the president or brought up the change, is whether the change in atmosphere now helps to encourage these people. Certainly, with no disrespect intended to our president, there are certain people that have been disenfranchised that feel somewhat validated. And I'd be curious if either of you have any feelings about whether that, to some folks, validates their belief in sovereignty, whether the noises that are being made, whether it's out of the White House or certain sectors within Washington, validate them and make them feel empowered.
I have an anecdote that that supports the idea that this is not political. This is not a left-right thing. I had a friend a couple decades ago who was indoctrinated into this theory through her church. And the main thing that she latched onto was that she didn't have to pay taxes. And after I got out of law school, she approached me and asked me if I would help her figure out how not to pay taxes under this theory. And I, you know, I told her I wouldn't help her because it wasn't a legitimate theory and that I wouldn't help her break the law. But she, in addition to believing that she didn't have to pay income taxes, she believed that this there was a worldwide conspiracy and that every president from Reagan had been involved in it. It was called, I think it was called the New World Order. And so both Democrats and Republicans. So the entire establishment was involved in this theory. And in her mind, it was all tied up with the sovereign citizen movement. So for that reason, just based on that one data point, it didn't appear to be a left-right dichotomy. Would you agree with that, David?
I would agree with that. I believe this originally was very politicized and was firmly in the camp of the hard right. I don't believe that that's true today. I think that you're seeing that this isn't an inherently political ideology. But the real story here is that this falls under the heading of something like fake news. And also the fact that the internet and YouTube in particular is a great agent for radicalizing people and for disseminating bad information. And it appeals to people who are in some way marginalized, who feel that they're marginalized, whether it be economically, whether it be socially. And take the point of view that the people in the courts, the attorneys, the judges, the law enforcement officials are all members of an elite that they're not a part of. And this is an avenue through which they can strike back. It's an avenue where they can flip the script. They can find that there's some secret truth or some secret incantations that they can use in court, and therefore they will have power over everyone else. I think this is rooted largely in people who feel powerless and want something that will allow them to feel powerful.
In a manner of speaking, do you feel that it's something people would use to explain why maybe they haven't had the successes they think they should have had? It was taken from them, perhaps?
Perhaps. I mean, that may be true in certain cases. I haven't heard anyone actually articulate that, though that may be true in a vaguer sense.
Well, from what I've read about this, there is this idea that this illegitimate government has actually enslaved them. In other words, there was the formerly legitimate government that operated under common law, and then it was secretly replaced by a new government system that they say was based on admiralty law, and that under common law they would have been free people, but under admiralty law they're slaves. And that secret government forces have a vested interest in keeping them that way. Do you understand that to be the basis of the sovereign citizens' beliefs, David?
The basic belief is that sovereign citizens believe that the American government, as it was set up by the founding fathers, was set up with a legal system that the sovereigns refer to as common law. And that was replaced by a new government system based on admiralty law, the law of the sea and international commerce. Under common law, sovereign citizens believed that they were free, and they often refer to themselves as free men. Under admiralty law, they believed that they became slaves. Now, there's differences in the narrative as to when this change took place. Some believe that it took place during the Civil War. Others believe it took place in 1933 when the U.S. abandoned the gold standard. But what's important is that they believe that the government somehow has pledged its citizens as collateral by selling their future earning capabilities to foreign investors, effectively enslaving all Americans, and that this sale takes place at birth. Sovereign citizens believe that when a baby is born, a birth certificate is issued, and the hospital requires that the parents apply for a Social Security number. The government then uses that birth certificate to set up a kind of corporate trust in the baby's name, a secret treasury account which it funds with an amount ranging anywhere from $600 to tens of millions of dollars. And by setting up this account, every newborn's rights are cleverly split between those held by the flesh and blood baby and those that are assigned to his or her corporate shell. And this is where you sometimes hear the ideology or the rhetoric that they have, I am not the person, I'm the corporation, or I'm the agent on behalf of the corporation. They believe that since most birth certificates use all capital letters to spell out the baby's name, that is actually the name of a corporate shell identity or straw man, and not their real name. And one of the key identifiers for sovereign citizens, especially in legal paperwork, is that they will use incorrect punctuation in their names. So if their name is David Thomas, they'll put a comma between David and Thomas, or a semicolon, or a dash. Sometimes they don't want to use their last name, which they believe is a government name, but David Thomas is their real name. And so they want to separate their names, and they have this idea that somehow by using this type of linguistic trickery that they can defeat the original purpose of the government, which was to separate this original legitimate system and the creation of an illegitimate system.
Don't they sometimes try and stop the courts from using their real names under the premise that they own copyright in the name and that they're not agreeing given the right to use that name, and so therefore the courts are illegitimately, for example, issuing traffic citations in their name.
Yes, and then they will turn around and sue for a copyright infringement. So they will claim that the judge has violated their copyright or trademark rights.
I would hope that even these folks would understand there are legitimate reasons for our government as we have it. Somebody's building the roads. Somebody's piping water to our homes. Things have changed because it's quite different what you need to do when you're housing a couple hundred thousand people as we had in the 13 colonies, as opposed to our current state where we're upwards of 300 million people. You can't survive by everybody having their own little plot of land and digging their way out of it with a shovel. Times have changed. We're nearing the top of the hour. It doesn't look like we're going to have any last-minute callers, but again, actually, what I would like to do, since we're at essentially the top of the hour, is to give each of you 1 or 2 minutes to sum up, if you would. If there's anything you would like to say to really sum up what we've been talking about, David?
Only that this is symptomatic, I think, of our times, and that those who practice in the courts have probably come across sovereign citizens or people who use sovereign citizen rhetoric or symbolism and may not have known it. So I think for those who are attorneys, they should become aware that this is growing. Those who sit on the bench should become aware that this is growing. Law enforcement officials should become aware and trained on how to deal with these kinds of people when they pull them over. It is a growing issue, and it's something that I don't think has any kind of clear solution in the near future.
But ultimately, don't you think this is just growing out of the schisms within our own society? People are more disconnected, they're angrier at one another than in recent times?
Yes, that's probably correct.
Kathy, what would you like to say in summary?
Well, I think this is an interesting topic, and I think that most people aren't aware of it. But I think it is something that all of us should be aware of. And to the extent that we have the opportunity to nip this in the bud, if we have any friends that are kind of dabbling in this theory or in this movement, I think it costs all of us in fairly benign and much more serious ways. I mean, it costs us in resources. Certainly, this impacts court processes, and it costs those of us who would like access to the court and have less access because of the defenses and so forth put forth by sovereign citizens. There's millions of dollars in tax revenue lost. We didn't really touch on that much, but the Southern Poverty Law Center estimates there's a 500,000 sovereign citizens that do not pay taxes. So you can imagine every year how much tax revenue is lost that way. But more seriously is the violence that takes place. David has mentioned a number of incidents in which police officers were killed or injured by sovereign citizens who became enraged when they were pulled over in a traffic stop or other law enforcement episodes. This is a serious cost to our society, and I think it's something that all of us should be aware of and take the opportunity to educate our neighbors if it presents itself.
And again, we're not necessarily talking about people going out and blowing up buildings, but there are those. But there's also those that blow up the processes so that the rest of us don't have access, whether it's being able to take a few moments and defend ourselves in court or receiving the care that we need for our children because the other party isn't paying them. There's that level as well of disruption.
I agree.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I am Jeff Hayden. Our guests tonight have been in the studio, David Nazzaro, attorney in San Mateo, California, and again, with his master's in national security studies and another master's in strategic intelligence, has quite a bit to bear on the larger picture and also of the localized picture of what this means when you have people that claim to be sovereign citizens and immune from our laws. On the phone with me tonight has been Kathleen Sherman, attorney in San Jose. Again, with her work within the court system, quite a bit of knowledge on how these people are tearing at the fabric that's making the court system run. I'd like to thank both of you for joining us here tonight. Next week, our topic on Your Legal Rights will involve the powers of the president. Can President Trump simply pardon himself? Can he choose to shut down the entire Russia investigation? Is he singularly above the law? Or for that matter, is he the law? And again, thank you for listening. And to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls tonight, Joanne Marr, I am Jeff Hayden.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.